feeling very, very inadequate. Whether I'm preaching or someone is singing or ministering in children's church, bringing a dessert for everyone to enjoy, whatever it may be, humanly we always see our inadequacies and the limitations, and it never quite turns out the way we desire. I thank you that when we come before you, it's always perfect. Your son's perfect. His sacrifice was perfect. Eternal life is perfect. And the home forever with you in the New Jerusalem will be perfect. So we rejoice in that and ask you now to take our limitations, our inadequacies, and to bless this time in your word that we understand it and can take what's perfect in an imperfect way as I present it and bring glory to your name in our lives today and this week and the days ahead. So thank you, Father, for all that you do. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen. A couple things I want to clarify here. One is the context we're in. Whose prophet is this? This man named Daniel. Young man becomes old man in the process. Whose prophet is he? God's prophet ultimately over what nation? What nation? He's a Jew. He's writing to the nation of Israel. Okay, that's a clarification you want to keep in your mind. A lot of this will make more sense when you go to that. Plus, the second thing I want to clarify, when I mentioned last week about 2,600 years and counting, I jumped in there kind of assuming some things and I confused you a little bit. Daniel wrote early on, around 600 B.C. Even if he wrote it 585, it'd still be about 2,600 years ago according to where we are in history. And so that's all he's referring to. He's talking about what was going on then, Babylon, who was reigning over Israel. Medo-Persians would reign over Israel. The Greeks would reign over Israel. And Rome would reign over Israel for how long? When will that finally be broken? When Jesus Christ returns. So guess what? Israel is not in the land. Israel is not free. And if you really stop and think about it, just back in 1948, what happened? A nation out of the Roman Empire, Great Britain, gave them their land, and who declared war on them the same day? Their enemies around them and attacked. And they attacked in 67, they attacked in 73. Israel has not had the peace that God has promised in a number of places. And I have so much I could share today, and I can't do too much of it. But there will be a lot of clear verses that are brought up from Scripture. And just to give you an example, Isaiah 9, 6 and 7. That prophesies about Christ returning as Prince of Peace. He's the one that's actually going to bring peace once and for all. Israel has not had peace since the Babylonians took them into captivity. They're not fulfilling what God has promised yet. They're still being dominated by nations of what is still the Roman Empire with the 10 toes, iron mixed with clay. It's still just beating and beating and beating on them. And they keep giving up and giving up and giving up. Yielding land, yielding rights. They keep trying to make peace treaties. They've been doing that since the 70s in our time. So you understand the picture, what I'm getting at. This 2,600 years has been because of Israel's sin and rebellion against God. It has persisted up to this day and is still counting until Jesus Christ returns. That's what I was focusing on last week. And so I clarify a little bit of that. But the thing that you really need to recognize, this prophet is to Israel. They're in captivity, but he's writing to his own people. And in turn, we are benefiting because of that. We are also learning by their example. We're also given hope, and we don't want to follow their example in many things that they did. So as you jump into the end of chapter 2 of Daniel, chapter 2, verses 31 to 49, there are three things that stand out here. And so there's an outline up here, and we're going to do some maps, but let me just kind of zip through. He gives them an initial report about what? What does the idea of report have to do with this passage? Verses listed 31 to 35. What's he initially tell them? How many read ahead with me? All right, good. What's the first chunk? Tells him the dream. So this is just factual. This is what you saw. It's all he's giving them. Basic facts, limited information, but so crystal clear that what is the facial expressions going on King Nebuchadnezzar's face? Yeah, his mouth opens. He's in shock. He's sitting there going, yeah, that's it, that's it. Oh, yep, that's it too. You're covering every single thing I saw. That's what's happening as he goes through this passage. So he reports back on the dream. Then what's he switch over to? 36 on down to 45. He goes to the whole picture, as we look down here, the revelations, I put it on here. He opens up the interpretation of the dream. Here's what you saw. Here's what it means. So he's going to lay all that out. And then when you get to the last part, 46 to 49, what's going on there? What's the recognition have to do? Who's being recognized? Daniel and God. Both of them. And ultimately, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego get pulled in because of Daniel. So that's the message in a nutshell. That's the 5-minute message. Now I'm going to give you the 45-minute message. Yeah. But you want to hang on to that framework. That's why I do outlines. I don't do them. In fact, my outline is far more detailed than yours. I gave you one that goes on the handout, and then I went back in and I kept breaking down the parts. Because it's the only way for me to know for sure that I'm teaching what it says, that I'm not making up something, which is really, really dangerous today. And common practice. Most preachers start with application. You'll find a lot of messages will start off with a really good story that either makes you laugh or cry. Because that sucks you in. And then you got them. If they hear nothing else, they say, what a great message. Hadn't heard that story before. Then they might move back to an interpretation of the passage as they start telling you some things about what it means, right or wrong. And then once in a while you get a little bit of the actual text. The observation. So it's really, really dangerous. That's why I encourage you to make the week the focus so that you're reading what it says and then making sure that when I get to the parts about what it means and what does it mean to me, that you've got the solid foundation of what God was trying to say, not just some other person out there. So he jumps into verse 31 in the midst of all this as he's been threatened. Remember what just happened in the middle of this chapter? What did Daniel just struggled with? So you can zip back down to the first one there, Tim, please. What had just happened? Really quick. Daniel went from being on death row to the end of this chapter to being exalted, second in command. Main dude over the wise man and over the prefects, the different rulers of the kingdom. And so you're going, how does God do that? He does it every day. We don't know a lot of what's going on. Daniel couldn't have told you at the beginning of this, oh, I'm not going to die. Unless he had promises from God that he knew were going to get fulfilled, then he would know, yep, no, I'm around for a while, so I don't have to worry about this. So as he runs through this situation, here's the report, verse 31. You, O King Nebuchadnezzar, who he's referring to, you were looking, you were contemplating, taking in the dream, just like you take in your dreams, right? Some of us take in our dreams with our mouths open, sucking air, shaking in our boots, waking up our spouse. Oh, I just had a bad dream. That's how we send them to take him in. Here's Nebuchadnezzar. He's contemplating, taking it in, and behold, take notice, there was a single great statue. That statue, which was large and of extraordinary splendor, was standing in front of you, and its appearance was, there's that word, Jim, awesome in the New American Standard. So he's laying out some things here as he goes in. He's going to focus on the statue and give you the emphasis. It's regal, single, large, awesome. It's the picture he's trying to portray here. It's one specific statue. And he says that it was great in the one description here. It means enormous would be an easy word for us to put in there. It carries the idea of much, but it's an enormous statue in his dream. And he says the statue is where you get the word image. We've all been made in the statue of God. Same word. What does that mean? It's a representation. It is an image of not what God looks like, because this statue didn't look like. Nebuchadnezzar didn't run around with a gold head and silver arms and breasts and all the way on down. That isn't what he looked like. It wasn't representing him physically, bodily, visually. It represented him in what way? Positionally, as the head only, as he gets down into this passage. But here's this image that is representing not only Babylon, with the gold, but also, who's the silver? Medo-Persia. Then you get to the bronze, Greece, and you get down to the iron, Rome, and then the iron mixed with clay is kind of the diffusion. They're trying to hold together, and you can kind of see that picture today in our world. It's exactly where we're at. So here's the statue. It's large, and again, if we just pick words that fit here, it is imposing. It's mighty. It's influential as he looks at it. It's extraordinary, carrying the idea of exceeding, and then extraordinary splendor, he says here, it's exceedingly bright. It's dazzling, is what he's trying to say. This thing would knock your socks off. You go into a jewelry store, you look at gold or silver jewelry. It's all been polished. It's all clean. And you go, oh, man, look at that. That really is gorgeous. Maybe even platinum in there. He's looking at a whole statue that looks like that. Just amazing to look at. It's standing or it stood in front of you, Nebuchadnezzar, and its appearance was awesome, carrying the idea of terrifying, frightening. So this isn't a good dream. This is more like a nightmare to Nebuchadnezzar. But Daniel has hit it right on the head, breast, arms, thighs, feet. Okay? He's right on the nose, yeah. And so he's laying this out, gives you this regal picture of what's going on here. And then he showed you some restrictions are built in. Said in verse 32, the head of that statue was made of fine gold. This wasn't some cheap stuff. It wasn't mixed with a bunch of things. This is fine gold. Its breast and arms of silver, its belly and its thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. So he's laying out these restrictions and he's trying to tell you there are limitations to each one of these features, and I'll explain them later. I'm just giving you what you saw. And so you understand that I really am telling you the truth. No questions asked here. This is real. And he lays this out. So he goes from the regalness to the restriction, as I put it. It goes from the special picture they looked at to the specifics of it, and yet he's not explaining anything at this point. He's just trying to lay it out. These are brought up in Daniel 7. It's mentioned in Revelation 13. There's some other things that are mentioned in Daniel 8, Daniel 10. This is brought out in a variety of pictures here. So God is trying to emphasize this. I'm going to come back to the question of why. Why is this important? Why start with Babylon to begin with? What happened to Assyria and Egypt and the nations before them? What's that? It's all focused around Israel's captivity. This is the domination that's kicked in, and it starts with Babylon. So he's trying to lay out, you're going to be conquered, defeated, suppressed, and picked on for centuries. From one king to another, to another, to another. But there's someone coming who's going to fix that. But you're going to have to learn your lesson. Where's America at today? America has been blessed and blessed and blessed and blessed. And what's it done with its blessings? What do some children do who are given too much? How do they treat their parents? They get spoiled and they what? They rebel because they think entitled. A couple more. Okay, they're elevated. They start thinking they're more important than their parents. None of us ever did that, did we? Okay, we'll pass on. That's convicting. But he's going through the statue initially. That's the layout. Then he goes right down to the stone. Look at verses 34 and 35 as he spells this out. You continued looking. He's still contemplating with his mouth open. Until a stone was cut out without hands, and it struck the statue on its feet of iron and clay and crushed them. That's an interesting statement, isn't it? He moves from the statue up here down to the stone. And also he lays out initially some things that are really fascinating to look at. It says this, it was a stone, first off. What's it look like? What shape? You have an immediate picture that pops in your heads. Round? Oblong? Rough? Smooth? What's it say there? It was cut out. What's it look like when it's cut out? You cut out round stones? Okay, some kind of cube or... Not round, not rough or round?
No, I mean, it's cut out.
So it has some kind of purpose to it. It looks like it's been created. But literally, when you look at the word was cut out, it is that hithpael, throwing out the little bit of the Hebrew. But in this case, it's Aramaic, so it's hithpael. They do them different. But it's trying to bring out the fact that it separated itself off. Who cut it? Wasn't cut by man. He says, without hands. Who did it? God did it. How does God cut stones? Any way He wants. So you kind of have this uncertain idea of what it looks like. It says here that it struck the statue. How did it get to the statue? That's why we think it was round and on an incline, right? We think it was cut out, rolled on down, boom, hit the statue. Only one bowling pin left, and it kind of took out that bowling pin. Harold?
In Isaiah, doesn't it say something about Jesus that He was uncomely and not necessarily
physically. Right. But again, his physical resemblance probably wouldn't be the picture that's being brought in here as of his spiritual significance of who he really was. But I just want you to look at this. When you're reading it, you sometimes kind of glance over some things. He's trying to stress here that he cut out himself. It's God who brought Jesus Christ. Jesus Christ is eternal. He brought him in by way of virgin birth. That is not normal. How do you describe that as being cut out? The Holy Spirit was involved with that. He resurrected. That is not normal. He ascended and sits at the right hand of the Father. You know anybody else up there? He has a very unique position. This is the without hands, literally by no human hand or without human help, is what he's trying to portray there. Jesus Christ came to earth, took on a role that God instituted and was behind all the way, and he takes who Jesus Christ is and he brings him to the statue ultimately because he only strikes him on his head? No. Arms? No. Chest? No. Thighs? No. What's he say? On its feet of iron and clay. What does that imply? It wasn't Babylon that was destroyed in the way he's going to destroy. It wasn't Medo-Persia. It wasn't Greece. And it wasn't even initially Rome until Rome has divided up into this iron and clay mixture, which is where we live today. Gary?
I was just saying that striking him at the feet, that's the way that you're standing up. It's God's fault.
Okay. It will bring down everything, and that's another interesting picture that Daniel is going to go on to explain as we go further into the book, especially chapter 7. But he's talking about on its feet, so it has to be way down the road. When did Rome come into the picture? About 600 years after Babylon. A little less, because it comes in around 30. And this is where if you kind of play with these numbers, they overlap. All those kingdoms, apart from the Medes and the Persians taking over Babylon in the night, you know, and they still had to go out and conquer armies and whatever was still out there. But these others have some overlapping. When Rome takes over Greece, there's four generals who are separated out. You have the Egyptian realm, you have the Syrian realm, you have the Macedonian realm. And it took time, and the last one to fall was Egypt. So they'll tell you in your books that Rome was about 63 B.C., but in reality, Egypt didn't fall till around 30 B.C. So you kind of have this uncertainty about how long, but as you go into these peoples, and I've written this down for later, but I'll just mention it. He's talking about Babylon lasting, and again, approximate numbers, and you can vary this, 87 years. Medo-Persia, about 200 years. Greece, about 300 years, maybe 270, depending on how you look at it. And then Rome, up to 500 years, depending on how you look at it. So each successive kingdom lasted longer and longer. Why was that? Gold is softer than silver. Silver is softer than bronze. Bronze is softer than iron. And even though it's mixed with clay, you still have a very strong, and he's going to describe it here, powerful, vicious nation of Rome. So the value you look at, you say, well, Babylon had more value, but Rome had greater strength. Babylon was more united. You don't find a lot of them killing each other. You go look on the layouts of the nation of Rome, and you'll find on there that big long thing that's 25 feet long, that huge thing. You look on there and it says killed, murdered, killed. Oh, he died on normal causes. That was kind of weird. Killed, murdered, killed. They had internal strife like crazy. It was just a matter of watching out. Somebody's going to take you out, and the next guy's going to step up. Babylon wasn't like that. That's what's fascinating. Even the Medes and the Persians had a little bit of clash between the two, but the Persians were a little stronger than the Medes, and they worked together. You get into Greece, Alexander the Great dominated. Four generals kind of had some problems. But it's just fascinating to look at the comparison of the value of the metals and then the power and the length of the empires. It's just some curious things that again, like I said, there's tons of stuff you could go into here that he's not really trying to focus on, but he's laying out that it's the feet that are wiped out by Jesus Christ. It's going to be in the future and in the latter days when he returns that Rome in the form of the ten toes is finally wiped out. And they call it the revived Roman Empire. Why would you have to revive something that never went away? It's kind of a misnomer. Rome didn't disappear, and we've had a nothing for a while, and then the ten toes will show up. Rome went into the ten toes, and it's been going on for 2,000 years. You understand that picture? When you actually start analyzing our world today, it's a Roman world. And I don't just mean Roman numerals or Latin that's still using some scientific or other ways, it has, still has great influences. When you think about the nations of the world, the powerful nations of the world, they are offshoots of the Roman Empire, which is really fascinating. China in the Asian Orient area kind of fits its own scenario, and they'll be the kings of the East. It'll come in at one point. But you start looking at Australia, South America, Central America, North America, North Africa, the Middle East, and a lot of what was going on that Rome dominated, all of Europe. You start looking at the picture and start realizing this is a Roman-dominated world that we still live in. But we'll get into more of that when we get into chapter 7. He says here that he crushed them. This, the word here that I would put in, if it was a Jack Edwards translation, he pulverized them. He shattered them. It's the picture, because you've got the clay here, and the iron is something that will shatter when it's hit appropriately. So then the iron in verse 35, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold, which order does he put them in? He just reversed it from what he had earlier. They were crushed or pulverized all at the same time. Wait a minute. Mark, you want to throw up picture number one, please? When you look at the way that the nations went, what area did Babylon cover? You see this Babylonian Empire? I don't know if I'm still blocking heads. You see it right in here, just kind of what they call the Fertile Crescent. Tigris and Euphrates rivers flowing up in here. Up into this region, they drop down into Israel. That's the Fertile Crescent. That was the Babylonian Empire. Number one, the head of gold. Who took them over? The Median Empire. They're bigger? They swing on out. Again, you guys can see color better than I can. I can see these lines. That really helps a whole lot. Much bigger empire flows up through Turkey and got a little bit into the Greece area. So they have these skirmishes and battles back and forth, and they start taking them out, and then Alexander the Great moves in. And the second picture, you see the Greek Empire pops up and overlaid on here. And here's the Greek Empire. Where is the Median Empire? Or Medes and Persians? Where are they? They've taken over within the same realm. So Babylon was taken over by the Medes. Greece has taken over the other. And then you bring in the Roman Empire, number three. And I know I'm moving these kind of quickly. And you see, it didn't go far out. The Parthian Empire grabbed onto some of what was out here. But it still takes in all of the Babylonian, a good chunk of the Medes and Persians, on into Greece. And then ultimately swing clear on out, even all the way up to Britain. So when he describes it here, they're crushed all at the same time. What you realize is, the Medes and the Persians absorbed the Babylonians, took advantage of some of the things that they offered there. The Greeks absorbed the Medes and the Persians and took advantage of what they had. And some of their culture kept going. They kept the good stuff. And then Rome took over and absorbed all of that in there today. And you can see it as we are a cosmopolitan blend of everything and anything when you think of the United States. What are terms that we use describing people in the United States? A melting pot. And that's exactly what's going on. You have representatives from all over the world living just here, let alone in a variety of other parts of this empire. So Rome had a specific boundary, as you see here, but when these started setting up their colonies and spreading out, they have pulled in bigger chunks. So the possibility, just to throw this out, just because I know you're curious, and I don't know the answer, but the possibility in the end is, all of the outlying colonies will not be effective compared to what will be this picture, especially around Israel. What some people want to tell us today is that here is the Babylonians obviously are represented in the nation of Iraq. The Persians are represented in the nation of Iran. The Greeks are representative in the nation of Syria and Egypt, where two of the generals ruled and fought, had problems between each other. Antiochus Epiphanes being one of those in Syria. And then you've got Turkey being representation of the eastern part of the Roman Empire. Constantinople being the capital and all. So what some want to teach today is that it's this realm that Israel is really in trouble about. It's all of her surrounding enemies are going to be the revived. I still use that word because I was taught that. This part of the Roman Empire that is going to cave in on the little nation of Israel and destroy them. So he's laying out, another question I have, why is he laying this information out to a Babylonian king? If he's a prophet of Israel, this message has gone to Israel, it's profitable for the church today to use this, Why is the dream given to a Babylonian king? I asked this last week, and I'm assuming you slept since then, so I'm asking again. Okay, the Jews have turned away from God, so God is going to now work through the Gentiles to get back to the Jews. Okay, that's probably the basic idea. Anything else stand out to you? What's that? God is... Okay, he's telling us future through his prophet, ultimately, because even the king didn't know what this was all about. So he is revealing a future. Jim?
Well, and I wondered, too, you know, like Romans 13 says, there is no authority but that established by God. So he obviously brought Nebuchadnezzar in to do his will with Israel.
Right.
And so now, I think in here somewhere it says he rules the world.
Yeah, and we can talk a little bit about that. But so he brings in Nebuchadnezzar to carry out his bidding, and when he's done with him in 536 or so, actually his son Belshazzar, his empire ends at that point in time. Bernie? Just a second. Bernie?
It shows Nebuchadnezzar how powerful his God is.
Okay, that's a secondary reason. He's not only trying to work with Israel, ultimately Nebuchadnezzar becomes a believer from all Old Testament standpoints. And how he responds to God and submits to him. In some ways. In other ways, he's still kind of loosey-goosey. Because he's just a God. So we can't tell if he's become monotheistic, but he recognizes him as the top God.
I just see it in the larger picture, the 2,600 years and counting. That means that we're experiencing what God predicted and through, you know, we're experiencing right now. And what that should do for us is humble us, inspire us, encourage us. And I believe that's why it was written this way.
Right. And so the first half of Daniel tells us what happened back then. The second half of Daniel tells us what's coming. Much of the second half of the book. Not unlike many of the prophets. They had present things that were being fulfilled, and then had things that were still off in the future somewhere. So as he walks down through here, he says that they were crushed all at the same time. So Rome is going to be a composite of Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, and its own empire. And it became like chaff from the summer threshing floors. We saved that, right? That's really good stuff. Yeah, it's worthless. So they want it to blow away. They don't even want to have to haul it anywhere. It's like, don't pile it up, just let it go. And he says, and the wind carried them away. Is that obliteration? Does it disappear? No, it just says the wind carried them away so that not a trace of them was found. It doesn't say they no longer exist on planet Earth. And I've stressed that because the end of Isaiah says that we're going to walk on the ashes of our enemies. And that's another whole thing I can't take time for. But as he goes down to the bottom here, he says, but the stone... Here's the statue being crushed, blown away. But the stone that struck the statue became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. What is Christ's empire going to rule over? Everything. When he describes the New Jerusalem, he tells you it's going to be how many miles cubed or squared? I should say squared. 1,500 miles. You go, whoa, that is a big place. That's half of the United States. From Canada down to Mexico and halfway across the United States, that's the city of Jerusalem. 1,500 miles high. So we don't know if that means to a point, that it's a like a diamond shape or a pyramid shape, or if it's more like a cube. But it says the light from that city illumines the whole earth. And the light doesn't come from the sun, because he says there's no need of the sun. It comes from the sun. Right? It doesn't come from the S-U-N, it comes from the S-O-N. So guess what? There isn't going to be any darkness for those people in Jerusalem. It's gone. No matter where the sun, S-U-N, is, the sun, S-O-N, is going to have light there all the time. Are you going to need to sleep? That came because of the curse. Adam and Eve would walk with God in the cool of the day. They had 24-hour day relationships. So there was really a shock when sin came in. But here's this great mountain, this new Jerusalem that kind of fits the picture there. And he fills the whole earth, and you can see some of that in prophecies elsewhere. So as he's working his way down, going back to our outline, you guys got enough of the Roman Empire for now? And he's going from the statue to the stone, giving him the interpretation as he moves in here into verse 36. Israel has been ruled by these four great kingdoms since their captivity, and he's going to lay out exactly, as this message goes to Israel, what is going to take place in the days ahead. Look at the Revelation, verse 36. This was the dream, says Daniel. Now we shall tell its interpretation before the king. Wait a minute. Has he got a frog in his pocket? Where did we come from? Okay, maybe it's God and Daniel. So he's trying to make sure you understand it didn't just come from me. Or he's got a frog in the pocket, right? It's a good possibility. You never know. Talking frog. No. Okay. So just notice the plural. And it's also brought up in verse 23 as you back where he said, if I can find it, to thee, O God of my fathers, I give thanks and praise, for thou hast given me wisdom and power. Even now thou hast made known to me what we requested of thee, for thou hast made known to us the king's matter. Uh-oh. Who's the us then in that case? Daniel and King Nebuchadnezzar. Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego aren't involved in this process. One man got the dream. Another man tells him what the dream's all about. So both of them have received this information. And so the we shall tell its interpretation before the king may be bringing God back in. So there may be some overlapping ideas that are happening here. But in verse 37, he says, you, O king, are the king of kings. Uh-oh, I thought they weren't allowed to say that. Isn't there just one king of kings? No. Just like there isn't one sovereign, and we keep stressing that sovereignty is not an attribute of God. It's a position he holds. And he ultimately will hold in full. But at this point in time, Nebuchadnezzar has been given that position by the king, by God himself. And it's the King of Kings to whom the God of heaven has given the first kingdom here. I'll put in that word first because this is the kingdom of gold. The power, the strength, and the glory. He's been given royal power, this position of dominance. He's been given the strength, the ability to rule, the might that's required here. And he's been given the glory, the honor that goes along with it. Very unique position. How many would vote for this? God, I like one of those. You want that position? Big weight on your shoulders. You think of what you've been responsible for in your life. Nothing like running the nation of Babylon. So this is a very unique man. And we told you he wasn't dumb. He interviewed. Remember, he was the one that gave approval. Very interesting man, but it's going to go to his head down the road here. Verse 38, wherever the sons of men dwell, or the beasts of the field, or the birds of the sky, he has given them into your hand and has caused you to rule over them all. You are the head of gold. Interesting description. He's describing the inhabited world. What did people in China think? What did some nations over in South America think about this at the time? Did he rule over them? No. Did they have any authority or power over him? No. So, but if they came together like the Spaniards when they came in from the Roman Empire, they dominated them. They dominated them. It's the picture that God has laid out, and he told them what would take place here. He had dominion over the whole civilized world. So we're focusing on Asia, focusing on this range of known peoples. But he has a very wide reach. But he tells them, you're the head of gold. In verse 39, after you, in about 536 or so, there will arise another second kingdom, I'll add a word there again, inferior to you. Now, he doesn't say another king, does he? He says another kingdom. When I was reading this week about King Nebuchadnezzar, he stands out, even in the area of Babylon. All the rest of the kings after him were nothing like him. Superior in every way, shape, and form. The kingdom was the best off when he was ruling. Others that took over for him were nobodies compared to him. But here he says, here's a second kingdom. So he's not locking in with the Medo-Persians into one individual. He's talking about the kingdom as a whole, and he says it's inferior to you. It's lower, literally, is what the Hebrew brings out. Why? Why was it lower? It had a bigger range, what we saw, and you don't need to bring it up. Why would he say it was inferior or lower? What was the difference between the Babylonian kingdom and the Medo-Persian kingdom? Right off, you know. Okay, maybe it got too big for its britches, but it already had two horns that are going to be talked about later in Daniel. So there was already some struggle between the two, and the Persians tended to dominate the Medes. But you read the history on that, and it's really, really fascinating. But in that way, it's inferior. The best kingdom that will ever reign on planet Earth is what kind of leadership? Called a dictatorship. Benevolent dictator, but a very firm, consistent dictator. You will not get away with anything in his kingdom. That's the best one. What's the problem when you give that kind of reign to a man like Nebuchadnezzar? He has good days and bad days. He has days when he decides, "Bip, you guys have been interpreting and telling me dreams for a long time." He said, "I thought I'd throw you a curve. Let's try something new. I'm not telling you the dream. You tell me the dream." What? No way. And you saw them appeal and appeal and appeal. It wasn't done. That's what a dictator can get away with. And then he can say, if you don't tell me it, you're all dead. Because he's a dictator, not very benevolent. With the Medes and the Persians, they modify things a little bit, because now you have the law of the Medes and the Persians. What happens when Daniel gets thrown in the lion's den? He can't undo the law. So he has to let God protect him. What happens in Esther when the law is set up through Haman to destroy the nation of Israel? He can't undo it. It's the law. It's fixed. The king doesn't have authority to undo that. So he has to instill a second law that gives them the freedom and the ability, without getting in trouble, to fight back. It's really interesting. It's inferior. It isn't going to work as well, and it didn't work as well. And so here he goes down to the second part of verse 39. Then another third kingdom of bronze, which will rule over all the earth. And you notice how Greece spreads out again, takes on that whole realm of peoples. But it's also inferior in the sense that its gold goes to silver, goes to bronze. It too had its own aspect of being inferior. What was wrong with Greece?
Too large an empire.
Okay, too large to keep track of, so you have to distribute. He had at least four generals who kind of ran areas and took over those areas once Alexander the Great was gone.
Gets diluted by all the different people and culture.
I heard your voice. I couldn't figure out where you were. Yeah, it gets diluted because now you've got a massive number of peoples, all different cultures and peoples to try to blend together and keep happy. That's why America works so well. And they're polytheistic, as were Medes and Persians, as were the Babylonians. But that continues to create severe problems, isn't there? When Jesus Christ comes back to rule, monotheistic. There is one God, and I am He. You know, there's a blending of the two. So here you wrestle down through and you get to verse 40. Then there will be a fourth kingdom as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron crushes, pulverizes, and shatters all things. It breaks it into pieces. This is fired clay he's talking about. And it's going to shatter, just like you take a clay thing that you made. Some of mine should have had that done to them when I was in school and you'd make up those kind of potteries. It would have been better off just to drop it from a good height and put it in the flower bed for whatever broken pottery is good for. It holds moisture, if nothing else. But here he is working through this process, and he's talking, he's laying out this fourth kingdom. It is strong. And then he gets to verse 41 as he walks through it, and I didn't give you a lot of details because I didn't have a lot of room. But he goes down through here, and he tells you in verse 41, and in that you saw the feet and the toes, partly of potter's clay, this is really brittle, been fired, partly of iron. It will be a divided kingdom, but it will have in it the toughness of iron, inasmuch as you saw the iron mixed with common clay. Throwing out a bunch of stuff here, and you're kind of going, well, what does he mean it will be a divided kingdom? What is that picture for you? What happened to Rome? Between the East and the West, they had a capital in Constantinople, a capital in Rome, and then what happened to the empire?
Conflict.
Where did one of the Caesars head off to? Well, he went off to Constantinople to reign from that side of the empire. It was a mess. You never knew who was going to stab you in the back. And it's an up-and-down thing. Again, reading about the Romans this week, super enjoyable to take in history and to see the realities of what happened. But this divided kingdom here carries the idea of being split. It implies weakness, but it has an inner disharmony, discord, creating a disloyalty. So it was the ununited nation, right? How are we doing today? How many nations are in the world that joined together for the United Nations? 269 or something like that. There's some number out there. How united are they? They're not at all. It's the same old thing. They picked a name that doesn't describe them at all. We should call them the ununited nations. All they get together for is spend money, try to control the world, cause drama for the newspapers to report, debate, and put out resolutions, and what's the difference between the United Nations and any other government in the world today? It's the same thing, folks. We don't live in a democracy. We live in a representative form of government called a republic. Most Americans don't understand it anymore. All they know they can say is, I have my rights. You have to listen to me. Really? How well are we doing on that? How do you put together 350 million or whatever number we've reached? You send representatives. And the representatives tell you what they're going to do, and then they go to Washington and they do whatever works best for them. Because they're told in Washington, if you don't agree with us, you're not going to get anywhere. So you're going to look really bad to your people. They're going to vote you out. You'll have accomplished nothing. And so they said, you got to work with us. That's how it works. So we don't really have a representative form of government anymore. America is getting weaker and weaker and weaker as it turns away from God. But he's describing Rome in a similar manner. He used a term here about being divided. In Genesis 10:25, the earth was divided. All kinds of debate over what that meant. Brought up again, repeated in 1 Chronicles 1:19. The earth was divided in the days of Peleg. He says in Psalm 55:9, they divide their tongues. You speak with forked tongue. You're saying two things out of the same mouth. Job 38:25, he cleft a channel, and I remember if it was a river or sea, what he's describing there. But he's trying to bring out the idea that there is a strong division here. And it's the iron and the clay. You got those that say, force, 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 strong army, strong military. You got other ones saying a whole bunch of other things. Which one do you want to pick? They're hung up on the environment. They're hung up on the economy. They're hung up on what? Helping everybody. Okay, charity. We're just going to become one big charity until all of a sudden we look around and there's nobody to give to us anymore. Because we took it all away. They're hung up on so many things, they're not hung up on God's will. That's what works. That's how America started. Not perfect, but they've gotten away from it. And it's fallen apart. That's this picture of this divided kingdom of Rome. And as to the toes in verse 42, the toes of the feet were partly iron, of iron and partly of pottery or fired clay. So some of the kingdom will be strong, mighty, overpowering, and part of it will be brittle, easily divided, broken into pieces. You just have to bring up the right issue, and all of a sudden it's kind of like Paul with the Sadducees and the Pharisees. When he looked out in the room, he said, I got two different groups here. All I have to do is bring up the resurrection. Boom! They're going at it. Paul just sits back over there and has a latte, right? This is what's going on here in the kingdom. And he says in 43, in that you saw the iron mixed with common clay, they will combine with one another in the seed or the offspring, the descendants of men. Many nationalities are going to come together. Many alliances and pacts will be merged. They will attempt that, but they will not adhere to one another. It won't work. There's a lack of cohesion between iron and clay. There's a lack of cohesion between people today. You can't get them to hardly agree on anything. Except Israel's bad. And the next one in line is Christians are just as bad. Those are two that are becoming a common denominator, in case you haven't been listening to the news. We're in trouble. Or are we? Nah, just a temporary blip in the radar. Christ will return. But this is where the struggle is going on. There's no peace in Israel. Pray for the peace of Jerusalem in Psalm 122:6. That's what God is desirous for us to have. So he's going down through these empires, gets down to Rome, and then we get to a fifth one in verse 44. In the days of those kings, when is that? When are those kings going to be? What kings is he talking about? You think it's just the ten, but he says in the days of the kings, Babylon, Medo-Persia, Greece, Rome. He says in the days of those kings, the God of heaven will set up a fifth kingdom, and I'll throw in the term there, which will never be destroyed. When was that kingdom set up? What was God doing at the time of Babylon? What did he promise Abraham? We just brought it up in class in Sunday school. You would have a seed. What happened during the Babylonian captivity to the seed of Abraham? God protected, reproduced, 70 years of captivity. They were having children. Within that line, God was keeping his promise because ultimately from the seed of Abraham would come the Christ. God oversaw that. What was Satan doing? He knew who it was. That's why he wanted him crucified. He's constantly trying to interrupt and interrupt. And so in the days of those kings, all the way through, God set up a kingdom that will never be destroyed, and that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush, there's that word again, it will put to an end all these kingdoms, but it will itself endure. It shall stand for how long?
Forever.
What am I spending my life on today? What am I preparing for? Retirement? I hope not. I keep warning you, one of these days, folks, I don't care how well you prepared, the banks are going to go, and whatever you buried in the ground is going to be worthless. Don't count on that. Don't live like that. My retirement, be wise. The righteous man has stores, a storage of good things in his house, oil and wine, I think he mentions it in Proverbs. It's not that you don't have stuff, but God is the one who takes care of us. And so when someone comes along with a need greater than mine, what do I do with my stuff? I give it to him like, okay, you didn't have a little bit. He tells us in 1 Timothy 6 to be generous with what we have. In 2 Corinthians 8 and 9, we are given in order to sow the seed, to multiply, not to hoard. This is a struggle we get into here. And again, I'm preaching to the choir right now. As far as financially goes, our church is as well off today after how long we've been around? 25 years as a church established. We're as well off today, and I mean literally this week, than I think we ever have been. Why? What are two things that come to mind? Either so that we can eat, drink, and be merry, or because what's God telling us?
God's setting us up for something.
He's setting us up. He is providing resources that now figure out and follow me how you're going to use this. So Gary and Sandy aren't going for 2 months this year. We're sending them out and we don't want you to come back. You didn't laugh strong enough for that. I was half kidding. But they're not. And there may be another team that's thinking about, you know, we think God might want to send us out for a month this year. We are being given resources to reach a lost world, resources to make disciples with. We need to figure out how to get that taken care of. We're trying to obey our government and do the things they've asked for as well, which includes landscaping, parking lots, and all the rest of the stuff. But this is really where the heart is. This is where God's heart is. This is the empire. This is the kingdom that we're really working toward. This is the one we can't wait to see. And when he shows up, we want him to say to us, well done, thou good and faithful servant. Where's that found in Scripture? Matthew. I'll give you some more time to check that one out. I can't give you all the answers because then you don't remember. You just chalk it up and you move on. So verse 45, he gets into this layout here of the prophetic side. He says, inasmuch as you saw that a stone was cut out of the mountain without hands, what mountain? All of a sudden a mountain gets thrown in here. Where'd the mountain come from? The stone was cut out of the mountain. What mountain? Another good question.
Does it matter?
He's telling you it matters or he wouldn't use the term. But Jesus Christ was the one. So, as you go down through here, maybe it's just generally the mountain of the world. Out of all the peoples of the world, here's a unique stone that was cut out. Without hands, God did it. It's hard to say, and I didn't find a good answer here. Some think it's Israel. Some think it's just the idea about a Mount Zion as far as speaking to a literal mountain. What? Oh. But you just gave the answer. Very good. Is that the only place it's found in the New Testament?
Revelation 1:12-13.
And which?
Revelation.
All right. Well, we'll have to see. We got to encourage others to make sure they look these up. Remember the memory verses that you're putting on your mirrors and your car and you're taking with you? That may not be at the top of your list, but it's a good one. So as he's walking through here, he says that kingdom will not be left for another people. It will crush. It will put to the end of the other's kingdom. Last forever. Going on down, I got a verse ahead of myself or behind myself. He says it crushed the iron, the bronze, the clay, the silver. Clay gets put down there really late. That's really fascinating. But anyway, the silver and the gold, the great God has made known to the king what will take place in the future. He's saying all these kingdoms are still going to be part of what's going on. They haven't disappeared. They have simply blended in with what's in the world today. What nations are hate Israel today? Babylon, Iraq. Persia, Iran. Greece, Syria, Egypt, Rome, Turkey, vibrant nations that are still part of this whole process, they're going to be the ones, you can see this, that are going to come in and devastate Israel. Whether it's their 12th Imam or whatever means the Antichrist is going to show his face, I don't know. But you can see it laid out here. The reason that iron comes first, then bronze, then clay, then silver, because he goes, it doesn't matter. It's just a hodgepodge. They're all going to have the same result. The great God has made known to the king, Nebuchadnezzar, what will take place in the future. So the dream is true. It is certain. It is firm. It will not change. And its interpretation is trustworthy. It's a sure deal. How are we doing with that? As he goes down here, God is going to set up a kingdom, and it will be the final kingdom, and it will take out all the ones previous, because they're all man-centered and godless. So let's get to the last part here, just to close off. There's recognition. The king Nebuchadnezzar fell on his face and did homage to Daniel. That's kind of strange, isn't it? What do you think his court people are thinking when they see this? Who's the last person he did that to? The guy should answer his wife, right? Come on, you had a chance there to put in some good word. But here he is. He's worshiping Daniel, falls on his face. He gives divine honor to him. And this is kind of the picture here. And did homage. This is literally the idea of being prostrate to Daniel, prostrate. And gave orders to present to him an offering. This kind of carries it. Is it a charitable gift of some sort? Or is it literally a sacrifice to him? And fragrant incense, which seems to go along with the idea of a sacrifice. He's worshiping the man. But he's worshiping through the man, recognizing who Daniel represents. Because that's what he does in verse 47. The king answered Daniel and said, "Surely your God is a God of gods." He's still polytheistic. "And surely he is a Lord of kings and a revealer of mysteries." I don't know what other gods have revealed any mysteries to him. But he's saying he's not the highest. Well, I mean, he may be highest, but he's not the only God. "Since you have been able to reveal this mystery, and that's who you got it from." Then the king promoted Daniel. Promotion. "And gave him many gifts, possessions. And he made him ruler over the whole province of Babylon and chief prefect, president over all the wise men of Babylon." Here's his position. Promotion, possessions, positions. He honors Daniel. He's lifted up from going to be dead one day to being top man under the king the next. And Daniel made request of the king. How long had Daniel been thinking about this? Last minute good idea? Or Daniel's going, God's going to open the doors up. He came prepared to answer the king on a regular basis. And he appointed Shadrach, Meshach, Abednego. Which names? Are those their Babylonian names or their Israeli names? Babylonian. Get thrown in there. Really strange. Over the administration of the province of Babylon while David was at the king's court. Daniel was now at the king's court. Thank you very much. Just an interesting picture written initially to Israel, eventually to us as the church, trying to point out through a Gentile king what's coming and is still coming, and we're still reading about it. And all of us are eagerly making preparations for Christ's return. Everything we do in our lives is about Christ's return. It's about the kingdom that's coming. It's not about the kingdom that exists today. You want to be a good citizen? Daniel was excellent. He impacted his country. He served them as under the Lord. Don't minimize what God's calling you to do, but don't get sidetracked. Don't make it the priority of your life. Make God the priority. That was a lot of verses to cover. So you gave me a couple of extra minutes in there, right? But it's an exciting message to remember. And it shows up, and it shows up, and it shows up in the Bible as you read on. Let's go to prayer. Father, help us to open our eyes to the realities of what's going on. Help us to not be surprised at the iron mixed with clay, the division that exists around our world. Help us to be excited about your son's return, the unity that will be in his government. There will not be one person that will not be in tune with him that is in positions of leadership. That in itself is amazing. I pray, Father, that that would be true about our church, that there wouldn't be one person in this church that is out of fellowship, out of unity with you, that they're walking by your Spirit, that they're putting you first, that they're not in hidden secret places carrying out things that displease you. So help us. We all need prayer. We all need encouragement. We all need instruction from your word. Continue to bless us so that we can bless others. And help us not to hoard your generosity. May we make disciples, and may you turn Lapine upside down, and in turn impact Central Oregon and the state of Oregon that is rapidly going off the deep end. May it be a lighthouse in the days ahead even though it may cost us dearly. Thank you for what you'll do, Father. In Jesus' name I pray. Amen.